Okay, welcome to this class on disobedience or disability. And to give you a little background for my history in this, I want to tell you a story from my first year of teaching. My first year of teaching was in 2001 in Belize. And I went to Belize, and one of the first persons I remember meeting at church was a little outgoing boy, and I'll call him Ricardo. "Welcome, Mr. John." He had this big beaming smile, and he was a very interesting young fellow. Got to know him just a little bit before school, and the school board met with the teachers. The school board, I'm going to use that term over and over, but actually it was just one person. This guy was overloaded, overworked, completely underpaid, and underappreciated probably. But he met with the teachers and he informed us that he didn't really care for any of these inventive punishments, like putting your name on the board, student's name on the board, or anything like that, or staying in for recess. He instructed us that in his opinion, if a student misbehaved, it was best to just use the rod. And I remember one of the teachers, he said, what do you mean by the rod? And I just remember thinking, where did he grow up? Because I knew what he meant by that. Right. And the school board was like, spanking. And he explained too that you could spank on the hand or whatever. Some of the students were pretty old. Anyway, a little awkward. In some ways, this was not really bad advice. I believe the school board wanted us to deal with disobedience right away, while it was small, to be the adult in the room. And I believe he was also leery of teachers trying to be their student's buddy way too much. But in many ways, it was not great advice for me. I was completely green as a teacher. I was going into a classroom with one known serious problem child and students who are very close to my own age and in the youth group. I believe I had one student who was just a year younger than me. I was a young teacher, green teacher. I followed his advice. I set up a discipline plan. He recommended a 3 strikes policy, so that's what I used. By 3 strikes, it meant you had 3 chances. And after your 3rd strike, then you got a punishment. And I don't really remember the details, honestly, but it was fairly simple. And I had fairly good order. Hardly had to give out any punishments all year. Seems like maybe just 3 or 4, I honestly barely remember. My students in this classroom were very used to fairly harsh punishment at home, what I would have considered harsh punishment, and so my punishments seemed fairly mild. So fairly good camaraderie in the classroom. Enjoyed my time. My students seemed to enjoy their time when they came to school, and we had a wonderful time. Lots of exciting times. Had a hurricane blow in and scared everybody. It was wonderful. Anyway. But incidentally, it did not work very well for the other teacher, this other fellow that I had mentioned. He seemed to have a real eager eye for anything that might be considered disobedience, and he was soon doling out punishments, spankings, left and right. And he was greatly disliked and disrespected by his students, and the disorder in his classroom was absolutely appalling. We got together for inter-school soccer game and different things. I just could not believe the chaos in his students. One image that sticks in my mind is him standing at the base of a tree trying to coax one of his students down so he could punish her. Kind of a very unfortunate situation there. He was dismissed at Christmas also. And like I said, it kind of worked out for me. This plan sort of worked out for me. For all my students except for one, this student had severe learning disabilities. As I look back at him, he was never diagnosed because we didn't even barely knew what that was. But he was very impulsive. He would blurt out all kinds of inappropriate comments all the time. He was very uncomfortable sometimes. And would just say things. And he was a runner. He would just run away. The first time I had the punishment, I think I kind of knew he was, and I cornered him. I waited to confront him until I could actually corner him and get a hold of him and okay, you need a spanking here. And so we did that. And the school board really told me that what he needs is a firm hand. He needs discipline. He needs a man to stand in his life and say, "Uh-uh, don't do that," when he starts goofing off. And then he would straighten up. I didn't actually find that to be true. There was some truth to it. It seemed like there was an older fellow that came and substituted, well, it was a school board, came and substituted for me one day. And so that was the technique he used, and it worked. I mean, this boy basically behaved. I do kind of wonder, looking back, how it worked for me now. I'm older, I'm meaner, I'm uglier, and I just wonder, would it work better now? Actually, I'm not meaner. I think I'm actually kinder than I used to be. But I still don't think it would work with this boy. And by the way, I've seen this before where maybe a school board, maybe it's another teacher, maybe it's a parent says, "This what this boy needs is a firm hand." And he says, "I'll come in and teach for a couple days. And I'll show you what he needs, the firm hand." And you know what? It works for a couple days. But I haven't seen it actually work long term. That's just my free thing there, okay? So eventually the board also decided, well, actually, Ricardo, he might need more than discipline. What he needs is incentive. And so we had a meeting with Ricardo and his parents, and the chairman told Ricardo that if he would behave in school, if he would behave and just obey Mr. John, don't be mean, don't be a bully, all those, why, he'll buy him, the chairman will buy him a brand new bike. And I remember seeing him, I remember seeing him just light up. "Yeah, it's great. What? And he is going to be so good. He is going to be the model boy." Do you think that worked?
No.
No. It did not work. He was not able to control his impulses even when he wanted to. So, this is a little bit of a difficult topic to tackle, and I say that because, not because it's impossible to discern between disobedience and disability, but because so often we can get in this headspace where we only hear what we want to hear. So I hope we just understand that about ourselves. I'm not even critical of people who are there, because they're usually there because they really care about someone and they're just desperate to help them in some way or other. They're desperate to fix a situation. We're grasping at ways to fix problems, and it's difficult for us to be objective. I also have a little anxiety about this because I have some experience with a teacher going to teacher meetings and looking for advice, maybe, hopefully looking for advice, but it seemed like she was looking for validation or whatever, and coming back with exactly the wrong advice and just kind of creating chaos. So, you know, as teachers, we all, I'm sure all of you teachers, want all of your students to reach their full potential. And how do we help them here? We want to see them succeed. So like I said, I'm intending for this class to be very interactive. I've been talking the whole time here, but you all are sort of listening. How so? I know that, what time is it? It is 3:25 in the afternoon, and you're just tired, and maybe you travel a long ways. And if you get just terribly sleepy, you can stand up or whatever, or just, "Hey, I have a question!" If you want to do that, help yourself anytime. Okay, so first of all here, what does disobedience look like? And I listed some things here just because I wanted to make a list. I kind of like lists. My wife liked lists. I didn't know she was going to sit in this class, but we like lists, and we can check things off and make us feel accomplished and, you know, powerful a little bit, especially if you can check things off your list. Got them done today. Well, these are not things you're supposed to be doing, but sometimes we hit them. Okay, so being slow to respond is the first one I have. It's one of the most irritating ones to me. I don't know if it's most. It's irritating. There's an oldest saying that says, delayed obedience is disobedience, moving as slowly as possible. It's just as slow as I can get by with. That's disobedience. Bad body language. I'm not going to talk about your body language because you're just sitting in chairs, you're uncomfortable, and if you're slouched, I don't care at all. However, when you're talking to a student, you can often tell by their body language if they're receptive to what you're saying or if they're not, right? Or if, you know, they're going to listen to what you have to say or if they're not. You can tell by their body language quite often. Non-compliance. What does non-compliance mean?
Not doing what you ask them.
Not doing what you ask. Yeah, that's right. It's very simple. Backtalk. I remember a preacher saying that there is never a reason to react harshly to your children, but he also said, backtalk is wicked. I don't remember exactly what he said, but if there's ever a time when you should slap their mouth, backtalk. I was a teenager then, and of course I never backtalked, but I did not like that mental image. Sulking is another thing that can just ruin your day. Or muttering or grumbling or just grumbling. Oh, it's terrible. Dishonesty in all shapes and all extents. Whether it's little things or blatant dishonesty. Very discouraging. As a teacher or a parent, whatever. Or complaining. The disobedient child is the one that complains quite often. Being inattentive and irresponsible. You know, it wasn't my fault, obviously, of being a poor sport. Those three. Are there any other things that you think of as you think about disobedient children? I could call on Miss Rowena back there because she always has an opinion. Okay.
John,
yes.
You mentioned always has an opinion. Is always having an opinion disobedience?
Always having an opinion disobedience.
Or is that a disability?
Might need to talk to my wife about that one. Okay, what do you think? Is always having an opinion about everything? And I know what you're talking about.
If a child has to have the last word and everything, would that be bordering on disobedience?
Then maybe come back to back talking.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. I've had different parents who knew their children well and knew their problems, and they would come and ask, you know, are they back talking? And I had to think, and because I'm not terribly intimidated by my students having an opinion, right? And I like a class that talks back, right? Not talks back, but, you know, answers back. Answers back? I think that's what I want to say. I don't mind them to have an opinion, I guess. But I know what you're saying, too. That's a good point.
I think if they take a step back, and if they're testing the line, you know, they're looking for security at some point, and different children take that further than others. But whenever you sense that there's like pushing the line.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that would go into the disobedience part of it or where that would go, but essentially I think they're looking for security.
Yeah.
In some sense or other. I don't think that would fall under the disability
mm-hmm.
part. That might be a different, mm-hmm. but yeah, some of that plays into the talking back and you know, having an opinion.
Probably should have had one on there just labeled, you know, disrespectful, and kind of tie into that too. And I have found that, especially as you encourage interaction in like a high school class, where you want them to be developing, you know, thinking patterns, and you want some adult content coming out of these discussions. Adult content has bad connotations, but what I mean is, you know what I mean, I think. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to go, let's look at the other list here. What are the symptoms of disability we encounter? And here's the thing to understand is that these things, these lists overlap so much. Or the second list greatly influences the first list. So you've got the first list, and you're going to have, again, you have the second list. If you have the second list, you will have some of the first list. Does that all make sense? I know that was terribly awkwardly worded, but. So the first one I have is being unable to cope with life. Now, if there's ever a general, really general description, it's that one. But it was kind of the first one that came to mind about somebody who's just stressed, just always stressed about everything. And I've had children like that, or I know children like that, who just couldn't deal with stress. And it was beyond a normal level. Everybody gets stressed. The second one is no episodic memory can go from being a dark thundercloud to bright and sunny and to a dark thundercloud just with almost no memory. Like, what happened in there? It's also why traditional forms of punishment or cause and effect just doesn't seem to register. And so they can do the same, they can make the same mistake over and over again. Overreacting to being hurt on the playground, and this was brought to my attention specifically by the different books by Tori Hyden, and she talks about these next several. I guess specifically the one she mentions, if you hear a child, an older child, just scream with no inhibitions. There's an inhibition towards screaming that you kind of develop by the time you're like 5 or 6, right? Unless you're just absolutely terrified, and you're life and death terrified, or great big, huge, enormous spider terrified, or something, why, you don't usually just have this blood-curdling scream over small things. And so, if you hear that from a 7 or 8 year old, and it's just normal playground stuff happening. Now, if they're really scared, if there's a huge event, that's different. But normal playground activity and somebody got mad and there's this, just terrible scream. I don't want to do it here because then they think I'm crazy. But that's an indication of something a little, they might just be having a bad day. If it's just one time, it's no big deal. But doing it over and over. Overreacting to being hurt on the playground. Screaming and running away. And this is one I understand that psychologists look at commonly. And what's funny is there was a student who told me about another student. He was a little bit pious, and it's like, that if they scream and run away, they're not hurt. Well, what's funny is the doctor told his parents that about him. Right, and so he was enjoying being the righteous one here. But that is a kid. If you see them scream and run away and hopping or whatever, they're probably not hurt, and it's usually an indication of some mental disturbance at least. Making the same mistake over and over again. This is one that I seem to do myself here. Obsessive behavior. And that can be, sometimes people have this who are just obsessive about cleanliness or just different things, or always turning off the stereo on a vowel or something. You've ever heard of that? There's things like that. Being easily distracted, very, very common one. Being uncomfortable with surprises is another one that's very common. I had to learn this. I liked surprises. I thought it was great, but very good indication of this. Now, this last one, did I put this last one on your... Yes. This is one somebody's going to have a question about this. So I have a student who can't get their work done. Just can't get their work done. They can barely get half the work done. Right? Anybody identify with that? And then, but if you really, if you give them an incentive, like if you say, if you all get your work done, we'll have a pizza party, you know, whatever your incentive is. Okay, if you all get your work done.
And then?
They can get their work done. Now, is that laziness? The easy answer is yes, that's laziness. But it's not that's not always right. And the reason is, think about this. We operate at our sustainable best. If you're a good, caring person, you do the best you can sustainably. But you do not put 100% effort in. No matter what the coaches say about needing 110% effort, which you can't actually give anyway, you don't do 100% all the time because you would just die. You do the best that you can sustainably do, right? So if a student is coming along, they're doing their sustainable best, and they hit this thing where there's this huge incentive, and they just give 100%, they just, whoa! And they achieve. Maybe they get a 95 on their quiz or whatever. And the teacher says, uh-huh. I said, just do that all the time. Well, here's the thing. You as a teacher don't perform like that all the time. So that's why you need to understand when this question comes up. And I don't know, I'm just going to guess some of you are going to have that question, right? What happens if I give an incentive and they can, and they get all the work done? I'm not trying to be dismissive or things, but it's not as simple as saying if you have an incentive and they get it done, they're lazy. Does that make sense? All right? Okay, good. Okay. So essentially, if we think about all of the most of vulnerabilities of childhood, I think that what we can see is that most of these are amplified in a child with disabilities. Okay, so children they're a little bit weaker than adults. They're emotionally not as secure. There's all kinds of things like this. And they're just amplified when a child has disabilities. For example, children and adults both tend to forget some things and remember others, okay? You know, you can remember something that's important to you and you forget something that's not. Hello, Kyle. Nice to see you. Welcome. So in this case, I should have had an example, but I can remember certain things. Oh, let's see. I can remember the name of a stonefly nymph that I like to tie. I can remember how to tie it perfectly. I did not have to go look it up. I've tied lots and lots of them because I like to fly fish and I like to catch big fish, and that's a wonderful thing. But there are so many other things that I've also done a lot of times that I actually forget how to do, even though I've done them, right? And that's maybe selective memory. Well, with a student with certain disabilities, they have the same kind of thing, but it's just amplified. The difference is sometimes if they want to remember it, they can't. Okay, I think I'm talking way too much. What kind of disabilities have you all encountered? Oh, I have one more point here. As we think about how much pressure we put on our students, maybe just think about that scenario I just mentioned, where if you give them incentive and they can accomplish it, then obviously, you know, your next step is to punish them when they don't. When they don't perform. If I asked you to come up here so I can make you look stupid, what would you do? Please come up here so I can make you look stupid. You would not do it. You would disobey me. Okay, here's the principle. Students would rather be bad than stupid. They would rather look bad than stupid. It's just a basic principle. And it's not just children, it's adults too. If there's something that you think is going to make them look stupid, make you look stupid, you just hesitate to do that. So, if students are constantly in this place where they just don't perform as well as others, it just puts a real pressure on them to not, as much as they can, not perform, right? Not step out, not give an answer. Okay? So, what kind of disabilities have you all encountered that are problems? What about dyslexia? Any of you have had that in your schools? If you're honest, you all have it in your schools, probably.
What's that?
Dyslexia? Okay. No. Just kidding. Okay. Level one. This is the one that I'm the most actually hopeful about and kind of excited about learning as we learn to work with students who think differently. I think there's all kinds of great potential there. What about, how many of you have worked with students who have something called FAS, or fetal alcohol syndrome? Okay, good, a couple. So what about students with vision problems, like double vision? Okay, or being colorblind? What about students with ADD or ADHD? Okay. Or what about RAD? Anybody work with students with RAD? Okay. Okay. What about autism? That's another one that's a little bit, okay, thank you. Autism is, the spectrum is just huge from completely normal to, like we probably are, maybe some of us have autism and we have no idea, very common. And some people can hardly function normally. I want to mention a couple things here really quickly. Students that have had with FAS, and there are other very similar things, but it's fetal alcohol syndrome. It's a little bit of a discouraging one because there are really no known cures. And so when you have a student with that, you really need to, you really need to be careful about holding them to the same line. How can I say that? Everybody needs to understand that there's consequences for disobedience. But they're different when a child has severe FAS. And as I understand that one, essentially when the brain is being formed, there are, for lack of a better term, there's like holes in the brain that actually form. So the information, there's information gaps. And I have seen that with a student where they're just desperately trying to remember something I just taught them. It should be right there, and they don't have it. It's just not there. Just desperately trying to answer and please the teacher and come up with some very random answers that they're just completely wrong. There is, hole in the brain, missing memory circuits, something like that. How many of you ever had students with hearing problems? Like they actually didn't hear very well?
That's okay.
Okay. You thought you did?
His parents took him to the doctor and came back and said his hearing is normal.
Okay. Maybe he had selective hearing a little bit.
Yeah. Just a bit of disobedience rather than
yeah. Okay. One thing too, if you have students that are autistic, they tend to have, or they can tend to have a, they can be very good at some things, which is lovely, and they can also tend to be very obsessive about some things. Interesting, we were just traveling through Wyoming, and we stopped, and I wanted to buy cinnamon rolls for my family. Went in there to this one of these truck stops, and they actually have kind of good cinnamon rolls if you're starving. So bought one of these packs of cinnamons, and this lady, when I walked up there and I said, I want four of them, and she said, do you want extra frosting on it? I said, no, there's plenty of frosting. I don't even like frosting that much. And so she got me stuff, boxed it up. Said, do you want frosting on it? Extra frosting? I said, no, that's good. And then she asked again, do you want frosting on that? More frosting on that. Sometimes the frosting kind of slides off. I said, no, it's fine. I was looking at her eyes just a little bit at that point. And so she rang me up, and she's giving me the bag, and she said, I'm just going to put a few cases of frosting in your bag here. And I had looked at her just a little bit carefully, and I was like, I could see clearly this woman had, she was autistic a little bit. However, I was really kind of tickled that she's there working, she's functioning well, but that is the type of thing that you can run into. Right, with just a little bit obsessive about things. And I've seen that too and enjoyed it too. I wanted to mention a couple of things here too. There's been different times when I run into students who had, they did not have these disabilities with acronyms, but they did not function well because of their home life. Very serious home life issues. One student had, he hardly got any sleep. His father's business was ongoing, it was just roaring throughout the night, and he slept in the living room. And so there's people coming in all the time, and he never got to sleep before 12:30. And so he has to get up and drive half an hour to school, and he's just always sleepy. He's just always, well, I just thought he was lazy. I mean, you really push him, he'd get his work done. He's just unmotivated and overweight. And I wish I had known a little bit more about his situation, and I would have probably treated him with a little more grace and mercy. And it would probably helped him. He actually did not do well. There was another one, too. And a bad home life and things like that have huge consequences for a child, too. Okay. Questions or comments on any of these things? How do you know this or how do you know that? Anything? Any questions?
You never followed through and said what that young man believes, what you would have diagnosed it as today. Told the story, you said you would have a diagnosis for it today. Did you have a specific in mind?
Ernest, I have thought about that, and I don't actually know. I tend to think with his parents' situation that he might have been had FAS, but I'm not sure. There's quite a number of people has said that young man was demon-possessed. Which I'm a little slow to call a child demon possessed, but with the culture there, I'm not sure. There was sometimes some real wildness in him.
Yeah, because I almost understood that there was something you had in mind. So
as I have dealt with children with FAS, it seemed like he was that way. He would have days that were good, like he was cooperative, and he was just the teacher's best helper, and he just loved him. he would come and he would talk to me and tell me his stories, and they were wild stories at times and crazy. And then he would just be terrible. He used to be terrible. I was just reading through some of my old notes about him. I remember one time he came to school with a machete after he had run away from school. Well, that was an intense little moment. He showed up at the door with a machete, stood there kind of with his big machete. What would you do? Well, I just ignored him. So eventually he went away. I don't know what I should have done. As I look back, we tried and tried and we did actually take him to a doctor, try to get him diagnosed. Of course, they just wanted to put him on medication, but we did actually try that. The school board did their very best. Really don't criticize them. They did their very best with that. And we just really didn't help him. He eventually grew up and started doing drugs. He was always kind of worried about, it seemed like he was always worried about the occult, like he was worried about being possessed. And there was a kind of a defining time when he got in a bad car wreck and the car went into the river and he couldn't get out. And he's drowning in there. And he prayed to get out and he couldn't get out. And he prayed to the devil to get out and he got out. And that caused him no end of fear. Like, did he sell his soul to the devil? And so pray for him today. He is really not doing well. Think about him. Okay. Well, I'm going to move on here quickly. How many of you have heard of ODD? ODD. Yes. So, Kyle, do you have any opinions on that?
I don't like it.
What's that?
I don't like it.
You don't like it? Okay.
But, I don't know. It's in all of us.
Yeah.
Like, every child will try. Were you obsessed with making your lines perfectly straight or doing something? Very obsessive.
Okay, so I'm talking about, I think I might have spoken.
OCD.
OCD.
Yeah, you're ODD.
ODD. Okay. When I tried to research disobedience in children, what came up online over and over again is ODD. And I asked a number of teachers, do you ever hear of ODD? Jonah's, isn't that the dog in Garfield? and essentially, ODD is oppositional defiance disorder. It might be a real thing, but as I look at the are you serious that we're done? We have 5 minutes? Okay. As I look at that, to me it looks like disobedience and carnality. It's in all of us, so I agree with what you said. oppositional defiance disorder, when I don't want to do what I'm told. That's considered a learning disability. Now somebody might listen to this and say, he doesn't know what he's talking about, or maybe you know more about it and than I do. Yes?
I heard of one child that was diagnosed with that by worldly psychologists, uh-huh. And it was along with the whole package of RAD, mm-hmm. All that.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's, and that's my understanding, that it's often just tacked on to this. So some of these other things are, RAD, for example, can be a real thing. It really changes how a person thinks and their securities and insecurities. But ODD, I tend to think it's just disobedience. It's just carnality.
That's
coming up.
Carnal term. I mean, it's not a scriptural term, right?
Correct. Right. Oppositional defiance disorder. So yeah. Okay. Well, I thought we had more time here. So I have three maxims here quickly. The first one is that there must always, no matter of the disability or whatever, how children learn or how they think, there always has to be consequences or punishment for disobedience. And I, as I've researched this a little bit too, this tends to be held widely by child psychologists who are secular. Okay, who would believe that using the rod or spanking is wrong, they would still say there has to be consequences for disobedience. Okay? As Christians, we should believe that clearly. We are not preparing them for a productive life if we teach them otherwise. The second point here is that as teachers, being fair is not the same thing as being equal. It's not always going to work to have a one-size-fits-all punishment system. Sometimes it does, but really sometimes it doesn't. A teacher I remember told his students at the beginning of the year, this year we're going to treat everybody as fairly as possible. Understand that being fair is not the same thing as being equal, and I will decide what is fair. And I think that actually can work if you have the student's heart and they know you're not trying to have favorites and all that. What should I have done differently with Ricardo? I should have probably realized that he's going to need more reminders and that I should never react to his behavior when he acts up. Maybe I should just let him act up for a little bit and come back to him when he's calm, but not chase him down. Now, it's interesting, just quickly here, Tori Hayden works with younger children and older children too, but when she's working with younger children, she has a runner or somebody like that, she will usually, once she gets to know them, she will take them and hold them and not let them run and not let them kick, just hold them. Interesting. And she's somebody who works with special children. And that is the way that she is more successful with them. Okay, and the third one is parents. Somebody told me, gave me this advice, work with the parents. So I just wrote parents. Work closely with the parents. These students, who do the students belong to in the end? Throwaway question, but seriously, in a lot of our interactions, or like the teacher thinks, if I could just do this with the student here. And the school board maybe gets on board with the teacher, or maybe is opposing the teacher, who knows. And the parents say, no, it won't work. What you are proposing won't work. In the end, who has the authority? Does somebody want to answer that?
Parents.
The parents have the authority. They have, the weight of responsibility lies with them. And somebody could take this the wrong way. But in the end, that is the case. The parents have the authority of raising the child. This class was intended to be either repeated or simply, what's the other word? Not repeated, but following. So continued, there you go. I feel like we hardly got started on this thing now. So I was going to just do a repeated one. But maybe, if you want to come back and we'll talk more about this, what do we do when there is conflict? How many of you are teachers here? Okay, most of you are teachers. Any parents here that are not teaching? I see one over there. I'm pretty sure she's not. Okay. So what do we do when there's conflict there? Do you have some great ideas? If you want to come back, we'll try to make sure and talk about that. But if you don't, that's fine too. Thank you for your attention.